From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Remember the room-sized mainframe computers whose computing power is now shrunk down to the size of a smartphone? Well, now imagine wispy computer circuits in and around your heart, your brain, on the surface of your skin, tracking and tweaking and optimizing. It's in the works. We'll talk with two top scientists in the midst of this technology revolution. This hour on Point, we look at the new frontier of implantable technologies, computer power in us and on us. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Can you imagine slapping on circuitry, plugging new upgrades into your body? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook. At On Point Radio. And let's just get it right out of the way. The Borg. Star Trek fans all know 1996 film First Contact and beyond. Earth is under attack from the Borg, a technology-empowered super species.
We are the Borg. Lower your shields and surrender your ships. We will add your biological and technological distinctiveness to our own. Your culture will adapt to service us. Resistance is futile
with the Borg, and they are wired to the max with all kinds of technology in them, on them, all around them. Maybe that's not exactly what people have in mind, but everybody thinks about it. So there it is. Joining us right now from Urbana, Illinois, is John Rogers, professor of materials science and engineering at the University of Illinois. He's at the forefront of new research bringing circuitry onto and into the body, has launched six companies around his research, was a 2009 MacArthur genius. He's an inventor on more than 80 patents and patent applications. John Rogers, thank you very much for being with us today.
Yeah, hi. It's a pleasure to be here.
You start with circuitry on the skin. That's hard to imagine, first of all. We think of rigid wafers and all the silicon and everything else. How are you slapping circuitry onto the skin, and what might it do for us, with us?
Well, yeah, you know, we can achieve that outcome. It turns out there are some pretty simple ideas, actually, in materials and mechanics that allow you to go from, you know, as you mentioned, the traditional integrated circuit format, which, you know, exists on the surface of a silicon wafer, which is basically a rock, you know, in terms of mechanical properties, a plate of glass. The way that we do it is we first shave the silicon into exceptionally thin wispy geometry. So instead of the millimeter thick plate of silicon, we use, you know, 100 nanometer thick sheets of silicon or ribbons of silicon. So that's, you know, a tenth of a micron. Diameter of a human hair is about 100 microns, just kind of set
which
the scale.
Which becomes flexible the way wood might sort of feel like paper if you sliced it that thin?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, a block of aluminum, you can't bend it, but aluminum foil, you can. It's the same material. It's just by virtue of making the material very thin that its bending rigidity decreases. And it tends to decrease, you know, at a power law function of the thickness. Mm-hmm. So you half the thickness and you reduce the bending rigidity by a factor of 10. So you go from a millimeter to 100 nanometers. That is a, you know, huge reduction in the rigidity. So things naturally become flexible in that type of format. So, you know, that's one simple idea. The details, you know, come in terms of how do you actually create that material. A silicon wafer is typically sawed, you know, with a mechanical saw from a large boule of silicon. You can't do that, you know, at thicknesses of 100 nanometers. But there's some etching tricks that allow you to shave off these kind of sheets from a silicon wafer. That gets you flexible. Now, it turns out, you know, the human body not only, you know, flexes, but it stretches. You know, think about the skin.
Sure.
I mean,
yeah,
it certainly folds and bends, but you can actually stretch it. And so you need more than just mechanical flexibility. You need, you know, the ability to stretch, which is a completely distinct type of mechanics. So a sheet of paper bends, it doesn't stretch. You need something more like, you know, silicone rubber or latex. So that's where, you know, one additional, you know, again, relatively simple idea comes into play, which is that, you know, silicon in this thin form is flexible. Now, if you take that flexible form of silicon and you bond it to a thin rubber substrate, and that's going to give you the overall elasticity, but you bond it to the rubber when it's slightly pre-stretched, what will happen is that when you relax that pre-strain, the rubber will snap back to its original dimensions, and in doing so, it puts the silicon in a state of compressive stress. And the way that it responds to that stress is to buckle into kind of a wavy shape. So you create in that way almost like an accordion bellows out of silicon. And that gets you the kind of elastic stretchability that you ultimately need to, you know, integrate, you know, on any kind of biological system, not just the skin, but the heart and the brain. All of these tissues have that kind of elasticity and curvilinear shape. But, you know, creating this kind of accordion out of silicon allows you an effective end-to-end stretchability, even though the material itself is not stretching. It's just kind of a geometrical construct that enables that outcome.
Professor Rogers, I put one foot in your spaceship and I feel like I'm flying all over the galaxy. That is really cool. That is really cool. Now, but let us, I mean, I'm sure that there are many PhD years in that and everything else. Let us mere mortals assume for a minute that it works. And now you're wrapping circuitry around my shoulder and across my chest and I don't know what all. What are we going to do with it?
Well, it turns out there are a lot of things. I mean, we're most interested in devices that can improve the way healthcare is delivered and done. And so that could range from advanced surgical tools, which are have the capacity to laminate in a soft way against the, you know, curvilinear time dynamic surfaces of the body. We have electronics as one example that go onto the surface of a balloon catheter, which is a standard surgical tool that's been used for many, many years primarily as a mechanical implement to deploy an intravascular stent or to break up a clogged region of an artery. But now we can put our stretchy electronics on that balloon and add, you know, in a qualitative way, all kinds of new functions. So not only can you affect this kind of mechanical intervention, but you can do precision sensing, you can do electrical stimulation, you can do ablation, you can put LEDs on these things, you can do photoactivation of drugs, all kinds of things, you know, begin to be possible. So, you know, that's one broad realm, which is, you know, advanced surgical diagnostic or interventional devices.
Let me hit the brakes with you a little bit there to get some of the texture of this. You're talking about potentially what? Wrapping something around the human heart in the body, like a bag or a sock around the heart that's doing what?
Well, so we've done both things. So one, kind of embodiment involves this, you know, instrumented electronic balloon catheter. In that case, it goes into the endocardial space. So you basically thread it up into the heart so you don't have to open the chest cavity. It comes in through a vein or an artery. You position it in the interior of the heart. And then once it's in that location, you blow up the balloon. And by doing so, you softly push the electronics and the sensors on this endocardial surface, the inner surfaces of the heart. And there you can do electrophysiological mapping. So you can look at the patterns of electrical activity that are synchronizing the contractions of the heart as it pumps. Now, it turns out...
So in a way, you're giving me a brain or a sensory tool inside my heart at that point.
That's right. So it's designed to facilitate minimally invasive interventional procedures that are used today to treat certain forms of arrhythmias. So some classes of irregular heartbeat are associated with poor signaling and electrical transport on the interior surfaces of the heart. This device allows you to map that so you can identify the location within the heart that is problematic. And it also allows you to intervene by an RF radio frequency ablation technique to basically burn that tissue away to eliminate the cause of this irregularity in the electrical behavior. So, you know, that would be one example. You mentioned
computer circuitry right in the heart. That's pretty wild. That is pretty wild. Okay.
Yeah, and you know the key point here, though, is it's a surgical tool, so it goes in, it comes back out.
Yeah,
Now, you can imagine, you know, more advanced devices that would stay in and continuously monitor and perform therapy as needed, maybe in an autonomous way. Now, that is more, you know, into the future. What we're talking about right now is a surgical tool that's under development at a commercial stage.
But you're headed for that future.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so, you know, my day job is to run an academic group and think, you know, 20 years out. So the sock concept is sort of more in that realm. So we have also shown that not only can you put electronics on a balloon, put it inside, you know, take it out as a surgical tool, but we can actually form in a, you know, 3D format, basically thin membranes that envelop the entire epicardium. So all the way around the entire outside of the heart. with a mechanical properties and characteristics that are comparable to the naturally occurring sac that envelops the heart, the pericardium.
Yes.
But ours is artificial, and it's loaded up with electronics, you know. So it goes around the outside of the heart. It doesn't constrain any of the natural motions because it's so thin and soft. The heart hardly knows that it's there in a mechanical sense. Yet it's tightly bonded enough that you get good coupling between the electronics and the heart. Now, the vision there is to do what I just described was possible with this balloon catheter, but in a way that would involve kind of an autonomous function. A surgeon wouldn't necessarily be involved, but this thing would just live on the outside of your heart. It would be mapping the electrical activity around the entire epicardium, and then if it sees some kind of irregularity, even before a full-blown arrhythmia develops, it could pace the heart in a sophisticated spatiotemporal way to avoid that kind of adverse health outcome before it ever, really occurred.
And that's just the heart. Presumably, one could imagine applications all over the human body.
Well, yeah, I mean, just to take a step back, I'm an engineer. My expertise is in electronic materials. We build widgets. We work very closely, though, with practicing clinicians. They tell us what's important in terms of device function. So, in terms of the clinical scenarios that I just described, those are coming from our collaborators. Now, there's, a number of opportunities in the heart. As you mentioned, other organs of the body are possible to look at as well. We've done things on the brain and the skin.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the push to implant new technology on and in the human body. To take computing power inside, make it part of us, John Rogers is with us. He's professor of materials science and engineering at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, MacArthur Genius Foundation Award winner, entrepreneur. He's out there doing it with all kinds of near-term stuff that's amazing and far-term stuff that's will blow your mind, easily to imagine it, dystopic as well. We'll talk about that. Dystopia, yes, plenty imagined here. 2013 film Elysium, the wealthy live on a man-made space station. Everybody else lives on a ruined Earth. Max, played by Matt Damon, tries to get up there to Elysium to save those on Earth. In this scene, a computer port is implanted in the back of his head.
What did you do to me?
Gave you a way out. Whoever has this has the power to override their whole system.
Override the whole system. I don't know, but the research is up and it's on the rails. And we've got lots of callers for you already. John Rogers in Urbana, Illinois. Runyon in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. What do you think, Runyon? You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am currently a medical physicist, and I was wondering if y'all could comment on the feasibility of this technology to detect microscopic disease. So more specifically, an issue with, our species in general is that we're going to expire. And the main thing that's keeping us from having a long life is cancer. Everyone is going to inevitably get cancer. And obviously, the earlier we detect these things, the better. So how well and on what sort of scale would you predict that this technology would be able to detect, a tumor a centimeter size or a tumor on the scale of a couple cells themselves?
Runyon, great question. John Rogers, how about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great sort of aspirational goal. We've certainly thought about it. I don't know that any of the systems that we have right now would be immediately applicable sort of at the microscopic level where you don't know within the body, where the cancer might start. So it really demands sort of a ubiquitous presence of electronic sensors and maybe, actuators and therapeutic devices.
Is that possible? Ubiquitous presence?
Well, yeah, I think that gets to be a little bit more challenging. I do think it's an interesting thing to think about. And, maybe some of the work that we're doing now would facilitate that kind of embodiment. But, we're not necessarily in that realm at the moment. Now, if you believe that cancer is going to begin in a specific location of the body, then you can imagine deploying an appropriate device to do the sensing and detection at that location. So, that's one thing I would say. It's a great goal. I'm not sure that we're there right now, but you can imagine different scenarios. The other thing that I would like to point out is that, at least in our research, most of what we've done so far really involves you know, an interface between the biotic system and the abiotic devices that we're building that sort of operate at the level of physics. So, you know, we measure surface potential. We can electrically stimulate. We measure forces and strain. We can measure temperature. What we're not doing at the moment is exchanging fluids, really speaking the natural language of biology, right? Proteins and fluids and ions. And that is definitely a direction that we are pursuing now. And I think it does have relevance to the question from the caller.
Can you imagine smart fluids, fluids that in effect would have the some equivalent of computer circuitry?
Yeah, so you can, I mean, a lot of our devices are built on, as we were talking about before, ultra-thin geometries. And, you know, the natural progression in mainstream semiconductor technology is to reduce the lateral dimensions of the devices. So you can imagine in the future, you know, suspended ultra-small, ultra-thin chips, right, that are flowing through fluids. Now, I would just caution that that is very much into the future. I mean, whenever FDA looks at approval, if you have particulates starting to move around in the bloodstream, there are all kinds of dangers associated with that. So it's a concept, but you know, a lot of challenges and problems with implementation.
Runyon,
good topics for research.
Yes, Runyon in Chapel Hill, thank you for your call. Let's get one from Flagstaff, Arizona. Ellis is calling. Hi, Ellis, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Okay. What's your question?
So a few years ago, I played a game called Deus Ex, and it dealt a lot with kind of augmentations.
A video game, I guess. Okay, yeah.
Video game, yep. And so one of the major themes of it was that long-term use of the augmentations would lead the body to start to reject them, and that rejection would cause debilitating pain and death in some people without the proper use of drugs to suppress those rejections. And I was just curious that when you guys talk about these kind of devices implanted in the body, would they be long-term, short-term, and is kind of the body's rejection, that's something you concern yourself with.
Very interesting. John Rogers, what about rejection? We know about transplant rejections. You're saying your stuff is abiotic. I don't know if rejection becomes an issue there. Maybe does it? And what if you start to get into this fluid realm?
Yeah, so the abiotic term is really referring more to man-made rather than anything associated with biocompatibility. But, you know, the caller is raising a critically important issue, so let me make a couple comments. Mm-hmm. So anytime you put something in the body, you have to worry about rejection, adverse immune response, biocompatibility in general. Now, if you think about biocompatibility, you can break it down into two pieces. One is a materials level compatibility. Is the chemistry toxic to the body? Does it elicit an immune response that has an adverse effect on the organism? That's a materials level consideration. The other one, which we have focused most of our efforts on, is around the geometrical and the structural aspects of biocompatibility, which is to say that if you have a material that is compatible, it's non-toxic, if it's rigid and hard and it's penetrating a soft tissue like the brain, that is going to cause problems as well in terms of biocompatibility. So I think where we have made contributions to this broader field of implantables is to focus on geometrical and mechanical modulus aspects of biocompatibility, where we're using materials that are already FDA approved for use as long-term implants in completely conventional embodiments, pacemakers, cochlear implants, you know, deep brain stimulators.
I mean,
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, one interesting thing there, I know you're working on it, may apply to Ellis's question out of Flagstaff, is this biodegradability.
Right.
You've got materials that you can put in there, they'll do a job for a while, and then just disintegrate, I guess, or degrade.
Exactly, yeah. So that was what I was going to get to, so I'm glad you brought it up. So biocompatibility also has a time scale associated with it, obviously. It doesn't need to last a year, 20 years, 25 years. I mean, different issues come up at different time scales. Now, those problems are hard problems, and people have been working on them for a long time, you know, around, you know, implants that exist today. We're trying to bring something new to the game in terms of mechanics and form, like I just mentioned. But those problems are going to take some time to work out. It turns out, however, that there are a number of device use case scenarios that do not require the device to be in the body for a long time. And in fact, having it around beyond a certain time frame is not necessarily a good thing, because it's just just unnecessary device load. For example, if you want to come back to the previous caller's question, you want to treat a cancerous tumor by releasing drugs over a period of time at the cancer site. If you are able to eliminate that tumor, then the device is no longer necessary. And ideally, you would like to have it simply biodegrade, enzymatically resorb, dissolve away into the body to eliminate the device entirely and thereby sidestep this more challenging issue of long-term biocompatibility. So that is another effort that's going on in our labs. We call it more generally transient electronics because it's physically transient. It could be biodegradable, but for other use cases, it doesn't even need to be in the body at all. There are all kinds of different things you could imagine doing with it.
Transient electronics, fascinating. I mean, Ellis is not the only one interested in all of this. You're doing work as well for the Pentagon, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, DARPA. I know you can't talk about that stuff exactly, but people have come, looked at your work, looked at their interest and their relation. I mean, the Observer out of England says, imagine what the military could do with these so-called born-to-die devices, the biodegradable. How about electronic eyes and ears that could be deployed for black ops in a war zone, then be triggered to dissolve when the mission was over or when they were about to be discovered? What about that whole realm, John Rogers?
Well, yeah, I think it's interesting. There's some stimulating intellectual challenges around how do you do materials that support high sophisticated electronic function, but at the same time can be made to vanish, in a triggered manner. You know, that's a pretty tough set of engineering challenges, and we like challenges, so we're working on those kinds of problems. I guess where, you know, we are a little bit more passionate and enthusiastic, and a lot of this sort of bubbles up from the students who are in my group, is around things that have potential benefits in human healthcare. So I think biodegradable versions of transient electronics is where our, you know, most vigorous, energetic efforts are. Mm-hmm. But there are all kinds of other uses in the military and secure, space, covert space, for example.
We'll look at that. John Rogers, stand by in Urbana, Illinois. With us right now as well from Princeton, New Jersey, is Michael McAlpine, professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering at Princeton. Michael McAlpine, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
John Rogers is most interested in health applications. You're interested in enhancement applications. I'm looking here, you're doing bionic nanotechnology and looking at the creation of bionic organs possessing enhanced functionalities over their biological, i.e. natural, I guess, counterparts. I'm looking at an ear in a petri dish. What, you want to pump us up, make us more than we are naturally, Michael?
Well, so we've actually had three different projects, three focus areas in the group. The first two actually have to do with taking some of the approaches that John has developed and applying them to a kind of more exotic materials, such as graphene for sensing on the body, sensing of, let's say, bacteria. We've also looked at these materials called piezoelectrics, which convert mechanical energy to electrical energy. Can you interface those, for example, onto lung tissue, the heart, the ribs, or in your shoes for converting repetitive mechanical motion done by the body into electrical power, let's say to power a pacemaker battery, prolong the life of the battery? And then the third thing...
I want to be sure I understand. You may give me an enhanced bionic organ that is powered by the action of my own lungs moving in and out bellows style.
Yeah, well, I mean, it sounds like science fiction in a way, but, you know, people do wear pacemakers now. They do wear cochlear implants. And so there are these devices that are already on the body. And, you know, the interesting thing is that they're basically used to restore impaired capabilities. But with this third project that you mentioned, which is this ear, we basically show that you can basically... instead of kind of merging electronics and the biology as a final step, the question was, can you actually grow an organ from scratch that had the electronics interwoven into it? And the way we accomplished that is by using a 3D printer and feeding biological materials, electronic materials, other types of materials into it to kind of create this ear. And it turns out that it hears a little bit differently than humans do, and that's kind of where this story came up of that you can perhaps use it for different capabilities or maybe even enhance augmented capabilities over what human biology ordinarily provides.
You write about the creation of bionic organs possessing enhanced functionalities over their biological counterparts. What senses or human capacities are you working on enhancing, or can you imagine enhancing, Michael?
Well, I think, a good example is this ear, where we basically showed that it hears in a different way than humans ordinarily hear. So the way humans hear is we receive acoustic sound waves, which then basically impinge onto little hair cells that vibrate and convert that vibrational energy into electrical, which goes to the brain. So the brain is primarily electrical. But this ear that we developed, it has a coil in it where basically it can receive electromagnetic signals. So you basically have a direct communication between electronic device like a cell phone mm-hmm. and the brain, which is electrical, skipping that middleman, the acoustic part, and just having direct electromagnetic communication. And again, it sounds like science fiction, but I've talked to people who wear cochlear implants, and it turns out that they can take their iPhone and plug it directly into the implant and skip the speaker on the phone, skip the microphone in the implant, and just have direct electrical communication.
Boy, I can imagine that for people with hearing issues could be amazing. I can also imagine SEAL Team 6 loving that, you know? I mean, they're talking to them straight out of the control. It sounds like a Homeland scenario if I ever heard one. Do you have DARPA funding as well, Michael, the Defense Department funding?
Yeah, we've had two DARPA projects, and so this year was partially funded by a DARPA project.
Bruce in Holman, Wisconsin. Bruce, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, Tom, I'm more than a little bit concerned about your unbridled enthusiasm for this technology. I can see and appreciate the potential medical benefits to people. However, what I'm concerned about is the potential downside to this technology. What happens when down the road at some future time, perhaps the large bulk of the population is implanted with various technologies to ensure their health or extend their life or perhaps make their life possible, and some individual, some terrorist groups, or government agencies decide they don't like what they're doing and push the off button?
Yeah, it's a good question, Bruce. I have unbridled enthusiasm to learn about it. Unbridled enthusiasm for applications like that? No, thank you. But we're here to figure out what's going on in the world. This is going on. Michael, how about it? I'm sure people that you've spoken with have said, oh boy, great, you're going to implant us with all this stuff, and then either it just goes wrong on its own, or somebody hits the off button, or we're hit by a solar flare, and zap, off we go.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's a concern. At the end of the day, we're doing the engineering, but, you know, I think every technology that's been developed, from even the most mundane to more sophisticated technologies, there's always been some concern about whether this technology can be used for good or for adverse purposes. And so, our job is kind of explore the science and explore the material space and the technology space and really push it to the limits to basically keep the good ahead of any kind of adverse uses. But this is true of any technology, and it's been a concern even back to vaccines and before that. And so, you know, it's something to think about, and there's definitely people who work on that kind of philosophical aspect. But, you know, we're here to kind of push these things in this direction, which is the natural progression of things anyway, so.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the new push to implant technology on and in the human body to take computing power inside, make it part of us, at least for a while. Michael McAlpine is with us. He's a professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering at Princeton University, looking at enhancing human capacity. John Rogers is with us, professor of materials science and engineering at the University of Illinois. He's looking primarily at this point at health issues, health care issues, but there are all kinds of frontiers here with all kinds of angles of interest. Steve is calling from Grays Lake, Illinois. Steve, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My comment focuses on the medical aspect mm-hmm. of this. My wife has had several very high-tech medical procedures that saved her life several times in her life.
Around what kind of ailment, if you don't mind, Steve?
Cardiac heart
okay.
issues.
Okay, yeah.
Way back in 1951, she became one of the first people, little kids in the United States, to have open heart surgery.
Wow.
This was before there was such a thing as a heart-lung machine, and it saved her life. And for the standards of the time, it was ultra-high tech. Most recently, she had a life-saving heart valve implanted via catheter going in through the neck arteries. The first person in this part of the Midwest to have that implanted in the tricuspid position. She's now doing great.
So what does that leave you thinking about this frontier, Steve?
What it tells me, and from personal experience, is when you're actually looking the tiger in the eye, your viewpoint on high-tech medicine may be quite different than when you're simply discussing it philosophically. When it's real and the consequences of not doing it are fatal, it's a whole different ballgame.
Steve, we hear it loud and clear when you're looking down the barrel of that mortality. I mean, it's so interesting here, John and Michael. I love the science itself, but the response, there's just waves of response here to this that are all over the board. Let me share some with you from my own Facebook and Twitter here. I mean, Drew says, I can't wait. Non-biological integration is the next step in evolution. Erica says, get ready to get your RFID, your radio frequency ID implant in your hand or forehead. The NSA won't need your smartphone to keep tabs on you any longer. Kevin says, humans being upgraded is a little too much like Doctor Who's Cybermen. Alex says, if we don't really trust our government to track us via phone and internet records, do we trust them with implanting electronics in the body? After all, you can turn your cell off, but turn off electronics in the body? Not so sure. John, do you run into this kind of question right away? Do you get a chance to lay out the science before it comes? And what do you think of the fears that come right alongside the hopes?
Well, I think it's legitimate, you know, quite frankly. You know, I think people should be thinking about, you know, the ways that this technology could be used for bad, you know, purposes, and, you know, figure out how to put the appropriate control systems in place that would, you know, allow us to exploit these things for you know, beneficial outcomes without having these downsides. So I think it's completely reasonable. I'm not probably the right person to think through the different options and controls and regulatory, you know, frameworks that might be put in place to sort of you know, limit or constrain the ways that these things are used. But it's reasonable. You know, the other thing that I would you know, comment on a couple things. One is, you know, the implants and augmented organs and this kind of thing. That's at least 10 years out. You know, we're developing the technology, Mike and I, and, you know, probably another, you know, half dozen groups around the world thinking about this. But there are pretty rigorous approval processes that are in place before you could ever get anything approved, you know, for long-term implantation. So this is not an issue that has to be grappled with immediately. We have time. We can do the right thing. The other, you know, comment I wanted to make really touches upon the previous caller. So we work with clinicians and surgeons in 7 different hospitals. We work with folks who are tetraplegics and epileptics and folks who are suffering from heart disease. And that creates a whole nother perspective on, you know, how you think about these technologies. And short of long-term implants, there's all kinds of near-term opportunities, advanced surgical tools, diagnostic devices that we talked about before that I think don't have some of these concerns attached to them that have near-term opportunities.
When you're looking the tiger in the eye, as our caller says, Amy in Shenandoah, Virginia. Amy, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. I just have a question. If there is any research pertaining to this with dementia and Alzheimer's, my mother got Alzheimer's 10 years early, and within a couple of years, she went from a full-time job to a nursing home. And I was wondering if there's any research pertaining to that.
Michael, I'll bring it first to you. Can you picture this being helpful therapeutically somehow or otherwise in the realm of dementia or Alzheimer's?
Well, we haven't looked at those two diseases particularly, but we did actually have a project for a while where we were looking at asthma, and we were looking actually at proteins that may occur, let's say, in the breath or saliva, which may be indicators that you have asthma, and using some of these kind of graphene sensors and then coating them with certain proteins or peptides to do kind of selective detection for certain disease indicators. And so you know, I think that it is kind of interesting where when you can start to interface these devices directly with the body, you can monitor these things continuously. So you don't it doesn't have to be a one-time brain surgery or kind of a one-time monitor. Maybe you can have something that can continuously monitor to say, so, like, instead mm-hmm. of, you know, I just had an asthma attack, because people have to wear, you know, people are actually tattooing themselves, because there's also this issue with the medical establishment. You know, there's no records to say if someone's having an asthma attack, there's no way to tell someone what's going on. So to have something that can continuously monitor and say, you know, I'm about to have an asthma attack, or I'm about, you know, I'm in the process of developing dementia or Alzheimer's, I see that as another benefit of having these things directly on the body for continuous monitoring, rather than dealing with it after the fact. You can monitor the progress as it goes along.
John, what about Alzheimer's and maybe intervention?
Yeah, it's a great question. We've done a lot of work on the brain, basically thin, you know, electronic saran wrap almost that sort of, you know, laminates onto the folds and the creases of the cortex. We work with experts in epilepsy at the Penn Epilepsy Center, University of Pennsylvania's medical school. So they're interested in mapping with as high spatial and temporal resolution as possible electrical activity on the surface of the brain of people who suffer from severe cases of epilepsy that are sort of not responsive to drug treatments. And there's a surgical procedure that involves resection of the part of the brain that is causing the seizures. And to locate that region of the brain, you need to do electrical mapping. And a trained surgeon can identify that position and do a resection. I mean, that's a pretty extreme surgical intervention. It's done routinely. What we're doing there is developing a very sophisticated diagnostic. Now, the next step is to do diagnostics, but then also do electrical stimulation, perhaps in a way that would prevent the onset of a seizure before it actually happens. Pick up electrical precursor signals that would indicate a seizure is about to happen, then stimulate. So, you know, the brain is an electrical system. I think if you want to study the function of the brain, you want to do therapy on the brain, the best way to think about that is to bring to bear to the problem the most sophisticated man-made electronics, which is the silicon integrated circuit. And that's what we're trying to do. And there are lots of opportunities there.
If I hear you right, you're talking there about monitoring. But what about intervention? And the Alzheimer's front, I mean, it's one thing to know it's coming or it's here. It's another thing to try and do something about it. Do you see potential there or not?
Oh, absolutely. So in the case of epilepsy, there is some data that indicate that you can electrically stimulate the brain to eliminate the onset of a seizure before it actually happens.
And so with Alzheimer's, what's the parallel or the implication?
Well, so getting Alzheimer's, there are also sort of electrical interventions that can be used to minimize symptoms of Parkinson's disease. There is some thought that there may be opportunities in Alzheimer's. The difficulty here is that there's a lot of science that's just unknown about mm-hmm. how the brain operates. So how do you engineer a system to manipulate the brain when you don't know how the brain is working? So it's a little bit of science and engineering that needs to progress before you'll have sort of a generic capability. But this idea of an electroceutical, sort of a kind of intervention that doesn't rely on drugs, but it relies on an electrical stimulation of an organ like the brain is one that is growing in popularity. And
wow.
I think there's a lot of opportunity there.
Electroceutical. There's a new word to tuck behind my ear. You've looked at mood in the brain and intervention along these lines. I think you've done some experiments with mice and light implants. What's the mood opportunity here?
Yeah, so in addition to electrical stimulation, it turns out that you can do genetic modifications of the brain that cause certain neural circuits to be sensitive to optical stimulation. So not only can you electrically trigger, you know, the function of the brain, but you can trigger it by shining light on it. And what we have done in collaboration with folks at Washington University is to exploit that optogenetic channel with our, you know, optoelectronic devices that will allow us to turn on and off LEDs that are implanted down into the depth of the brain, configured such that we can stimulate part of the brain that's responsible for production of dopamine. And dopamine creates a pleasure response that can act as a calming effect, or you can actually do complex behavioral training without a physical reward by turning an LED on and off and creating this pleasure response. And it's fully wirelessly operated. So I think not only electrical but optical stimulation in the context of the brain, you know, has a lot of promise.
My mind is blown. I'm going to have to take some hours to take this fully on board. Jeremy in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Jeremy, you're on the air.
Wow, Tom, like you, I share an unbridled enthusiasm to learn about implantable tech, and I completely agree that this is going to take a while to kind of soak in. I am fascinated by learning, and not just learning about the tech, but what are the implications of how we can learn with this type of technology. We do amazing things in schools right now with kids who have access to iPhones and iPads and other smartphones as supplemental brains almost. What about if that brain can talk directly with our own brains? How far off are we on that? I'm interested in how far off we are on all these things. Is this my lifetime, my son's lifetime?
Let us pick it up. Jeremy, Michael, what about it? Learning, human learning. Can you imagine this kind of tech implant embedding, somehow enhancing learning?
Well, I definitely think so. I mean, there's various ways you can look at it. I mean, the first thing is, you know, if you think about the devices that we carry around with us now, these cell phones, I mean, they're basically infinite encyclopedias that you can refer to it at any time. So you basically have this tool that you can learn from in your pocket. I mean, when my girlfriend and I, we go out to eat and we don't know what a certain item is on the menu, we can immediately look it up. I mean, that's a form of learning which is immediate and can be done directly on the spot. If you think about something like this, the ear that we made and cochlear implants in general, when you have these devices that go to the brain or near the brain, there's a relearning that has to be done as well. So people who get cochlear implants, they have to kind of relearn how to hear because the signals that are being transported by the implant are a little bit different than the way you normally hear. And so you kind of have to kind of relearn how to hear. And so that's another form of learning that would take place when you have these devices on the body. And then the third thing is if you think of something like Google Glass and these smartwatches, you know, this is something where you have real-time learning, Google Glass, that would be going on continuously and interactively. And so I do think that it's a pretty exciting area to think about. And another example of this technology being used for good, I mean, you know that kids, you can't take away their iPads from them now. And so it's a way that, you know, learning becomes fun and interactive. So
now I'm trying to listen just as hard as I can there. When you use the phrase real-time learning, I'm suddenly imagining or perceiving what you mean there is just data coming in from an exterior source that may even be interior but not organic. I mean, could you have real-time learning but know nothing? You know, we think of learning leading to knowledge, learning leading to knowing, but if everything is just dumped in by a device or a device that's implanted, do you really know anything, Michael? Or is that an old-fashioned distinction?
I mean, it's the same kind of argument that used to be made when kids started getting calculators. You know, do they really know how to do math? And you know, I think that these tools help. I mean, I use navigation systems now, so that's a real-time process where I can learn the correct route or the fastest route around certain traffic regions in order to get from one place to another. So I think you know, these things are. Anything that kind of helps people improve their lives, whether it's health or whether it's learning or preventing certain diseases, then these are things that we're excited about. So,
John Rogers, give us one more before we lose you. Where else? I don't know, on the skin or somewhere else? Well, you're bringing the tech on, bringing the computer on or into the body. What else that we haven't discussed?
Yeah, so, you know, I don't think we talked all that much about the skin, but, you know, I think that's a really appealing point for mounting devices because it's completely non-invasive and, you know, it has the potential to get this kind of technology out of kind of a clinical hospital setting into the real world. And so the notion of being able to do continuous, sophisticated, highly functional, you know, interfaces to the body using the skin as a window is something that I think has the potential to really change the way that healthcare is done. So
that tattoo might be smart. Yeah. It might actually be a circuit.
Well, absolutely. So, you know, you can do a lot of very sophisticated physiological health status monitoring just by measuring, you know, various parameters through the skin, precision temperature mapping. You can measure biopotentials, skin galvanic response, hydration, all this sort of stuff. And you can make these devices such that they offer wireless communication links to your cell phone, and your doctor can then have access to this data all the time. And so the hope is that you could reduce the costs and improve the outcomes of the way healthcare is delivered just by using this kind of technology and wearing it all the time.
Who's the oversight for all this? As you guys, you know, surge forward, who's watching? Is this the FDA's writ, or does it even come under their umbrella? Who's weighing all this?
Yeah, so it really depends on how the device is being marketed and what it's doing. So you can go all the way from fitness and sports as non-regulated, cosmetics. As you move into healthcare, it becomes a regulatory process that flows through the FDA.
I am just about speechless at the end of just 1 hour with you all. I wish we had more. But you open up a great big horizon, at least to me. I've known some of this, but this takes us further. Lots to be weighed and measured and considered and meditated on here. But thank you so much for opening our eyes. John Rogers at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, thank you very much for being with us today, John.
Thank you.
And Michael McAlpine at Princeton University in Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering there. Michael, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, there's plenty to chew on. There's plenty to think about. May need an implant to get through it. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.